Chapter 3, Day 254. Theta MAB South, 04:10. Kaminsky wasn't due on until 6, but the birds were disturbing his slumber. He'd learned to sleep through regular jet sounds, the ruckus that had been going on every night for the last 9 months. What bothered his sleep now were the new noises the Navy machines had brought with them, the shrill wails and spitting roars of vector thrust craft coming and going. He wasn't used to those sounds, and his sleeping self hadn't yet learned to screen them out. And Throne, weren't they busy? Kaminsky had counted at least 3 sortie launches since nightfall, and there'd also been a hell of a lot of noise around midnight, which he was sure was a new wing arriving for deployment. Things were hotting up. Kaminsky had heard rumors, a friend of a friend in the motor pool, who knew a guy who got talking to a Navy fitter, rumors that there had already been a few air brawls this side of the mountains. Some business had gone down over the Leader Valley the day before. Someone else said they'd seen bats over the peninsula. That was probably crap. Kaminsky hoped so, because if it was true, that meant they really were near the end. But the Leader Valley, that was possible, and bad enough. The bats had got reach. Maybe even the vaunted Imperial Navy wings couldn't stop them now. They were trying, though. Kaminsky left his bunk in the Munitorum dorm and walked down the dimly lit and blast-hardened hallway to section post. The 5 guys who were meant to be on standby were asleep in chairs. The jet roar hadn't woken them. They were all Munitorum drivers, born and bred. They were oblivious to the subtle changes in the noise over the field. Kaminsky helped himself to some caffeine from the pot on the stove and went out into the motor pool yard. The air was cold, and the night still very black. Several tech priests were working on some cargo 8s, lighting the corner of the yard with the tremulous glow of their welding wands and incense burners. Sipping his drink, Kaminsky strolled up the ramp until he was overlooking the main field. Guide path flares had just been lit, filling the night with a lambent green light. Thanks to this, he could see a row of thunderbolts hunched under mesh tents to the west. His guess had been right. They hadn't been there the day before. A newly arrived wing. More reinforcements. A shuddering rush swept over him, out of the south, and he turned to watch another wing come in, returning from a sortie. Thunderbolts, too. He liked the look of those big brutes, and wondered how they felt to fly. The 12 machines came in low, following the guide path, and began to slow, turning their forward rate into a gentle hover as they adjusted their vector jets and settled down onto their designated pads. The monstrous combined howl of their engines made his diaphragm shake.
"Good day, guys," he called to them, out loud. "Many kills?"
He toasted the distant plains with his cup. He could remember the buzz so clearly. Riding home, guns empty, flying on fumes, the rush of a combat survived, still twitching in his gut. As the throb of the mighty turbofans began to fade, Kaminsky turned, hearing voices suddenly audible back in the yard. He wandered back that way and saw Senior Pynchon standing in conversation with a Navy flyer. Pynchon looked flustered, which was never good for anyone else. The senior noticed Kaminsky approaching and called out to him,
"I need a driver."
"Ready and willing, Senior," Kaminsky replied.
Though he wasn't due on yet, he knew he wouldn't be doing any more sleeping now. He fancied a little distraction. Besides, he didn't want Pynchon blithering into the section post and finding all the standbys asleep. The poor bastards would be on penalty shifts until doomsday, which, of course, might be just a few days away.
"I'll take it," he said.
"Good. Transportation run. Conveyance needed to the old town and back. Fill this in."
Kaminsky took the proffered data slate and entered his work number and details. He wrote as quickly and neatly as his hand would allow.
"I need to go to a bar called the Hydra," the Navy flyer said. "Do you know it?"
Kaminsky looked up at the sound of the voice and saw to his surprise that the tall flyer was female. It was the woman whose mob he'd transported in 2 days earlier.
"Yes, mademoiselle. Forgive me, Commander. I know it."
"Good," she said.
She nodded thanks to Pynchon and fell into step beside Kaminsky as they headed for his transport.
"You'll ride in the cab?" he asked.
"Thanks, yes."
He opened the cab door for her, and she climbed up. Then he went round to the driver's side, boarded, and turned the engine over. Lamps blazing, they rumbled out of the compound and left the airfield, joining the empty highway strip into the city.
She said nothing, just gazed out at the hooded lights of the field as they went by and receded. It felt funny having company in the cab. He usually shipped teams of personnel around, loaded in the back. The cab was his private space. He felt embarrassed suddenly by the litter of disposable cups in the footwell, the fact that someone could see the way he had to lock his prosthetic hand around the wheel spoke. But it would have been rude to expect her to ride in the rear. At length, uncomfortable, he cleared his throat and said,
"The Hydra, you said?"
"Yes, on Voldney."
"Yeah."
Did she recognize him? Half of him presumed not, just another Munitorum drone. The other half was outraged. With a face like his? The thought made him smile. Suddenly, August, vain about your looks. "Something the matter, driver?" she asked.
"No, Commander," he said. "I'm to wait for you at the Hydra, is that right?"
"Yes. I shouldn't be more than 5 minutes."
"Not going out for a celebratory drink, then?"
"No, why?"
"Oh, you know, a flyer back from a mission, wanting to wind down. The Hydra is popular with pilots."
"So I've heard." "So what's this about, then?" he wanted to ask. But he stopped himself. It wasn't his place. He wasn't one of them anymore, and he couldn't get away with insolence. He was a Munitorum drone. As if she sensed his curiosity, she suddenly said, "I'm looking for an FDR.
"Ah,"
he said. Understanding, he smiled again. He was flattered that she should bother to make even that much conversation. She said nothing else until they were pulling up outside the Hydra.
"Wait here,"
she instructed, and jumped down out of the cab. 5 minutes passed. 10. A trio of drunken Commonwealth troopers staggered out of the bar like a six-legged beast and blundered off down the pavement, singing. It was dark. Just the lights of his truck, the neon bar sign, a few still-lit windows overlooking the narrow street. He saw her re-emerge, alone. She looked up and down the street, annoyed. She crossed back to the driver's side, and he wound down his window.
"Not there."
"No. Is there anywhere else you know?"
"A few places. Get in."
He drove down through the Gillihal Plaza, and, as there was no one around, took a shortcut up a one-way ramp onto the shelving streets of the Zagahans. The truck's gears wallowed as he downshifted on the steep slope.
"Where are we going?" she asked.
"There are a couple of places up here, the Lullaby and the Midwinter. They're often open after hours," she nodded. "How long's he been gone?"
"Since 2200 yesterday."
"And you don't want to make this official?"
No.
"What's your name?"
he asked.
"Jagdeer,"
she said, reluctantly. He waited for her at the Lullaby and the Midwinter, but she came back from both on her own.
"One last idea. There's a place on the Grand Canal."
He drove the truck expertly along the narrow old town streets. There was just the tiniest hint of dawn in the air now. When they got to the place, he turned off the engine and climbed down with her.
"You can stay with the transport driver."
Kaminsky shook his head.
"Actually, no, Commander Jagdeer. You'll need me to get in."
"Why?"
"Zara's is an old drinking den, not a bar. Women are only allowed in if they are the companions of male clientele."
She stared at him.
"It's true,"
he said.
Maybe that's why your FTR came here."
Together, they walked to an iron-hinged door, set down from the street by three little steps. Kaminsky knocked, and the door opened. The door guard was a massive Ingeborgen with fat hooded eyes. He looked them up and down, then waved them through. The den was almost empty. Some chairs were already up on tables. Half a dozen Commonwealth flyers, all male, were playing cards around a corner table. A yawning waitress was serving them another bottle of Joylik. Two Navy flyers shared another booth, talking in low, fierce voices about something. A few other patrons sat alone or played the chancer machines with their last pieces of change.
"Is he here?"
whispered Kaminsky.
"That's him, at the bar."
There was a boy sitting at the bar side. A handsome sort, Kaminsky realized. He put the thought aside. Any one of the bastards in the room was handsome compared to him. But still, this boy was especially handsome. Dark-haired, fair-skinned, tall. Clearly from the same gene pool that had produced the striking Commander Jagdeer. The boy was very drunk. A weary barman was cleaning a glass and watching in horrid fascination as the boy tried to find his mouth with a shot cup. He missed, emptied the dregs of the liquor down his front, and then settled the glass on the marble bar top again. He tapped it with an index finger.
One more.
The barman shook his head.
Oh, for shiz's sake, one more, so I ask.
No, said the barman.
Time to go home, Vander,
Jagda said. The boy looked at her, blinked, and shook his head.
Yes, Vander, come home now, and we can forget this.
No, 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 no. I'm washed up.
You're in your cups, but you're not washed up. Come on, I've got transport.
The boy, Vander, fixed her with suddenly probing eyes.
Espère,
he spat.
He's in the infirmary. They're patching him up.
Espère, he won't fly again.
No, he won't. But that's not down to you.
I got him hurt.
No, you didn't.
Yes. Yes, I got him hurt. I got him hurt. I got him hurt. I did. Me. I screwed up.
Maybe you did, Vander. Maybe you didn't. No one's blaming you for what happened to Pers.
Killed a cyclone, too.
What?
The boy made a shrugging movement with his hands.
Killed a cyclone. Killed a cyclone. Shot a frigging thing to pieces. Like...
No, Vander. We went over the gun cam footage. The cyclone was stung by a bat. Not you.
Yeah?
Yes. Not you.
That's so.
Yes, it is. Now come on, pilot, get up. We're going now.
Vander shook his head.
I swear,
he muttered. Jagdir took a step towards him and put her hand on his arm.
That's it, Markwell. Enough with the self-pity. Get your ass upright and follow me.
Go away.
Markwell, I've stuck my neck out for you. My whole neck. I came looking for you rather than report you are overdue. So far, it's off the record.
She looked round at Kaminsky.
It is off the record, isn't it?
Kaminsky shrugged.
Sure.
She shook Markwell.
See what I do for you? It's off the record. I didn't report you to the commissariat. I could lose command for letting you run off like this. FTR failed to return. You're 4 hours late back at billet. The commissars would shoot you for this. Shoot me too. Don't mess me up, Markwell. Don't you dare earn the Fantine a rep for screw-ups and disobedience. We're running with the frigging Navy now. Get up, Markwell. Don't you disgrace me. I need you.
He looked at her, blinking to focus.
You don't need me.
I lost a pilot yesterday. I'll be damned if I lose two.
She pulled his arm, and he struggled back. Kaminsky winced as the boy fell off his seat. He spilled Commander Jagdia over with him as he went, and a glass broke.
That's enough,
the barman cried. The Ingeborgen thug was closing in.
It's okay,
Kaminsky said, holding up his hand. He helped Jagdia up and pushed her aside. Then he stood over the boy.
Call yourself a flyer,
he said.
Huh?
Markwell gurgled.
What are you doing?
Jagdia began.
Don't worry,
Kaminsky told her.
Let me speak to the lad. I don't want any trouble.
He looked down at the boy again.
You're a pilot. You get to fly. I tell you what. You're a piece of crap.
What?
A piece of crap. You disgust me. Your mamzelle there has gone out on a line to pull your ass in, and this is what you do. Can you fly? Can you fly?
Yes.
Can you fly?
Yes.
Why don't you then?
I don't know.
Kaminsky reached under his coat and pulled out his service auto. He dropped it onto the boy's belly. The falling weight winded him.
Just use it.
What?
Use it. Use it now.
What?
Use the frigging gun, you waste of space. Put a shot through your stupid brain. It'll be quicker than drinking yourself to death. Do us all a favor.
Markwell stared at the gun on his belly as if it was a venomous arachnid.
What are you waiting for, huh? You get to fly, you bastard. You get to fly. Why would you run away from that? I used to fly too, but I got crisped. See this? My face, my hand? They say I can never fly again. I'm not airworthy. I'd give anything to be you. Anything. So pick up that frigging gun and stop me envying your stupid little life.
Shit, said Markwell. You can't say that to me.
No, he can't, said Jagdia, kneeling beside him. But it seems he just did. Now, are we going home?
or am I going to leave you with him?
Home,
agreed Markwell, closing his eyes. Jagdia tossed the service pistol back to Kaminsky. He caught it.
Yours, I believe.
Then she hauled Markwell up on her shoulder and carried him out of the bar. She was sitting with him in the back space of the truck when Kaminsky came out. He looked at her.
Drive, please, she said firmly.
Kaminsky got up into the cab. Alone again, he started the engine. South of the Machanites. 08:30. 30,000 meters, not a cloud in the sky, just 24 silver giants, leaving white lines of vapor across the blue. Viltry felt much more at ease on this early run, Halo Flight's second sortie of the tour. He wondered if it was strength of numbers. Halo was running in formation with marauders of 22 12th Navy, and they had a wing of Thunderbolts 5,000 meters above them, flying top cover. Formation safety. Or maybe it was the soothing effects of a long afternoon spent gazing at the sea. Whatever, he was more relaxed. Greta felt good and responsive. Sunlight filled the cabin with a golden glaze, and the world seemed almost silent. At this altitude, the engines were a muffled throb. The loudest sounds were the hiss of the air mix and the pump of his mask. He imagined this serenity was what it was like to be deep under the sea. Lacombe passed a sheaf of plastic-sheathed charts over to him. He took another look at the recon data. As of 1700 hours the day before, it had been confirmed, thanks, he was proud to note, to the action of a Fantine wing, Jagdia's mob, bless them, that the enemy had secured air range beyond the mountain limits. That meant almost certainly they had established forward air bases in the interior desert, maybe even mobile land carriers, far further north than had been previously estimated by operations. Aerial recon had spotted a few probable heat sources overnight, and now their formation, callsign Hightail, and nine other formations like them, were aloft on interdiction missions. If the enemy had air bases in the northern desert, they had to be hit now and taken out, or the show would be over before it began. Hightail had already spotted half a dozen possibles during their flying time, but all had turned out to be masses of Imperial ground forces laboring north. From this great height, Viltry enjoyed an awesome panorama of the desert, intractable and vast. It was ragged terrain, resembling worn sandpaper. Over to the west, hundreds of kilometers away, he could make out the margins of the cicatrices, a huge rift of scarred land that ancient geology had gouged out across the continent, probably around the same time it had lifted the Machanites to overlook it. Flying in that region was said to be tough, especially at lower levels. The scar valleys caused savage and unpredictable wind shears and cross-currents. According to the recon brief, they were now just 50 kilometers short of one of the most likely target areas, a high-density heat and magnetics return from a dune sea region called the Dish of Sand. There was a Navy Marauder, Hightail 1, flying about 20 kilometers ahead of them. Carrying zero payload to remain svelte and fleet, its orspecs boosted and amped, Hightail 1 was their pathfinder. Viltry waited patiently for the go or no. He had a good feeling about this one. Then he saw the bats. It was the strangest thing. It was like no one else had seen them. No alarm had come up. No squawk. There were nine of them, crimson blades, knifing in out of the east across the formation's port flank. Enemy! Enemy! 9 o'clock and inbound! Viltry yelled. He heard the main turret above and behind him whirring as the servos spun it. The vox was suddenly bursting with voices. Greta shook gently as, up in the turret, Gaze began firing the twin heavy bolters. Viltry saw tracer fire stitch out and fall to his left. The bats, hellraisers, smashed in through the belly of the formation, weapon mounts flashing as they came. Where the hell was top cover?
Vox discipline! Vox discipline!
Viltry yelled, trying to still the agitated shouting of his crew.
Visual scanning! Conserve fire! We're in a formation, so no wild firing! Pick targets! Track them!
Hightail was flying in overlapping diamond formations. Effectively, that meant each machine had the protection of its neighbors, and each diamond the protection of the diamond or diamonds adjoining it, plus top cover to fill in as needed. So deployed, and carrying such heavy turret weapons, the marauders effectively formed a flying fortification that should, technically, be impossible to breach. But the Hellraisers had gone under them once, and two of the Navy machines were reporting hits taken. The lead Navy marauder, called Holy Terra, had formation command. Viltry could hear the Terra's commander, a man called Egsor, barking orders to the flight to maintain pattern.
Viltry was checking to his starboard. The bats had gone that way, and logic said that that was where they'd come back from. He jumped in his harness as two thunderbolts power-dived past his starboard wingtip, burning around west. Greta rocked in their slipwake.
"Where the hell were you, top cover?" he boxed.
"No chatter," he heard Exor snarl back.
"Six, six, 6 o'clock!"
It was Orson in the tail, and his yells were echoed by the tail gunners of all the other machines. The bats had swept out wide and come in from the rear for their second pass.
"Tail gunner engaging!"
Orson screamed over the vox, and Viltry felt the shudder of the tail mount unloading. A moment later, and the top turret, now screwed over to face the rear, joined in. The twin heavy discharge did slight but strange things to Greta's ride, and Viltry compensated expertly. Then the bats rushed by them. The tail guns ceased fire, the targets having crossed beyond their traverse limit, but the top turret continued blazing as it rotated, following the pass. As the rear ends of the Hellraisers, bright with full burn, swept ahead and away from them, the nose turret joined in too.
"Cease! Cease fire!" Viltry cried out.
The bats were at 3 kilometers now, and extending, pulling out of reasonable range. He could still just see their engine flares as they broke, scattering into a fan. "Damn," Viltry thought. "Now they'll be making individual passes." There was a screech over the vox. Viltry looked around desperately and saw one of the Navy Marauders in the adjacent diamond begin to fall out of formation. It seemed as if its engines could no longer hold its weight in the air. A gout of black smoke coughed from one engine, then flames took fierce hold of the entire leading edge of the port wing. The bats had scored on their second pass. Trailing flame, the Marauder began to steepen in its descent.
"Eject! Eject!"
he heard Exor yelling to the distant crew. The dipping Marauder suddenly shuddered and blew up. Its bomb load made a vast fire cloud in the clear sky, jetting debris out in a whirl of scrap. The main part of the nose, burning like a comet, arced away down towards the desert.
"Here they come,"
Naxol cried. At least the nose gunner had shown the good sense to keep scanning instead of watching the Marauder die. 3 Hellraisers were coming in on a frontal attack. Their weapons crackled and flashed brilliantly. Naxol and Gaze opened up on the nearest as it came in across them. Naxol's meaty lasfire chopped the air behind it, but Gaze had held a fine deflection. The bat as good as flew into his bolter stream. It came apart in a drizzle of metal shards and flame, its forewings separating and spinning out like broken plate glass. Whipping over and under as it tumbled away, the starboard wing nearly hit Greta's tail. Viltry sucked in his breath at the near miss.
"Good one, Gaze," he voxed.
Get them all back, and one of the Navy machines had also scored good hits. A Hellraiser went into an uncontrolled spin and fell out of the sky, and another pulled a wobbly turn out and began to limp away west, making smoke. But it wasn't over yet. Another Navy Marauder had been hit and had fallen out of formation, unable to keep up. And K for Killshot had taken vector duct damage. The bats were coming in again, and the Auspex showed that another wave had now joined them. Over in the western sky, Viltry saw a starburst flash as a thunderbolt detonated. His hands were shaking again. Fate's wheel. Fate's wheel. Turning closer every moment. Theda MAB North, 1201. Noisy, chattering, the streams of Commonwealth personnel flooded out of the station towards the waiting transports. All of them carried kit bags or hefted crates in teams. They joked in the sunny air, throwing wisecracks and jibes around. It was a mask, a front. Bravado. Darrow knew that. In a few hours, these men would be on their way to rear-line postings down the coast, possibly across the sea. Friendships would be broken. Comrades parted from one another. Out on the concourse, hundreds of silent Navy men waited around the transports that had just brought them in, ready to move in and take over as soon as the Commonwealth bodies were gone. Darrow glanced at them. Some smoked. Others basked in the sun, stretched out on the rockcrete. Many stared, flat, unfriendly stares. If you'd done this properly, you know, really fought for your world properly, we wouldn't have to be here. That's why Darrow's fellow staffers and crew were laughing and joking. They didn't want to have to look at the Imperials hovering like vultures over a corpse. Darrow felt like dropping his own kit bag and returning the stares. Supercilious bastards. You think we wanted this? You think we're grateful you show up now? Go screw yourselves. We fought for Enothis. We bled. We died. Thanks to us, it's still here to fight for. We did the hard work. Now you sweep in to get the glory. And so help me, you had better get the glory. You had better win, or...
Darrow! Darrow!
He turned. Major Heckle had appeared on the station steps, waving at him. He made his way back through the mass of personnel to reach him.
Congratulations, sir, he said.
What?
I saw you'd been posted to quarry flight.
A muscle under Heckle's left eye ticked slightly.
Yes, lucky me. They've got to keep us old hands going, I suppose.
Heckle made a high-pitched little laugh, a false sound. His eye ticked again.
You wanted me, sir?
Oh, yes,
said Heckle. He reached into the pocket of his flight coat and produced a docket wafer. It was sealed. Darrow's name was printed on the flap. Darrow noticed how badly Heckle's hand was quaking as he passed it to him.
This is for you.
Darrow tore open the wafer.
Eads had it sent down. I think he was feeling sorry for you. It's not active as such, but he says he hopes it will do.
He's posting me to operations.
Effective immediate.
Darrow grinned. Heckle was right. It wasn't active, but it would mean he'd stay at Theta and be part of the real thing.
Thanks, he said.
Just a messenger, shrugged Heckle.
You put in a good word, I'm sure.
Heckle shrugged again, but he was grinning this time. Then his expression grew serious.
Just between you and me, Darrow, the enemy got airspace reach into the Leader Valley yesterday. The schedule's really moved up. The Navy's decided it needs local experts who are familiar with the topography to guide them, so they asked Eads to consult at operations. He told me he wanted a few good bodies to assist him. I suggested you and a couple of others who'd been moved to reserve.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Heckle nodded.
Just do a good job, Darrow.
Darrow put down his pack and saluted his former leader.
Darrow, Heckle said.
His face had a strange, wistful look.
Darrow, do you think they know I'm sorry?
Who, sir?
The cadets. Hunt flight. Emperor Saver, so many of them died.
You did everything you could, sir.
Heckle breathed deeply.
You know, Darrow, that's just what I'm afraid of.
Heckle picked up his pack, patted Darrow on the arm, and hurried away towards the transports. Theta MAB South, 1534.
She's jinxed, isn't she?
Millen Blancher said.
Who's that, sir?
Asked Hemmen, the chief fitter. In the shadow of the great hangar, his team was working on the refit of a spares Thunderbolt. The air was popping with the rattle of power ratchets. Her, Jagdeer said, pointing at the wounded machine.
Serial 99, Hemmen shook his head. I couldn't possibly comment, Mademoiselle Commander.
Jagdeer shook her head and led Blancher out of the barn. The field was clear apart from Umbra Flight's birds and a thundering pack of Commonwealth interceptors taxiing for takeoff.
A spur?
Blancher asked. Forget it. He'll be out for months, and even with augmetics, he's a wreck.
So we're a man down?
Yes. I asked Navy Reserve, but they said every able pilot was committed. Unless there's suddenly a bird down and a pilot recovered or a bird malfunctioned. God, Emperor Mill, this war front stretched really thin. Every man, every plane thrown in. I think this could be the big one.
What do you mean?
The decider. The archenemy has got the Crusade trapped, overextended. They're attacking here and at Herador. That's the latest news. Either planet falls and the Crusade line gets beheaded. Snip, good night. Good night, War Master Makarov. Good night, us, and good night, Crusade. If our line breaks here, they'll be all over us like a body bag.
We'd better fly our balls off, then,
Blancher said. She smiled. Speak for yourself.
How's Markwell?
She shrugged. Still trying to heave the soles of his feet out through his mouth in the shower block. I thought about slipping him some detox tabs, but then I had a bad attack of what the hell. A crippling hangover is the Emperor's way of making us remember our mistakes.
He blames himself for a spare.
Yes, he does.
Should he?
Blancher asked. Jagdeer shrugged. Her reply was totally drowned out by the squadron of prop planes taking to the air.
Say it again,
said Blancher. Markwell screwed up. He flew like a virgin and made just about every mistake going. A spare was covering him. So, yes, he should. But he's also a decent pilot, I know that. We need him. And we need him back, confident, learning from his mistakes.
I still don't know how you trawled him in, Blancher said.
Doesn't matter. I had help. Not the sort of help I wanted, but... Well, it worked. Blancher shrugged. I'll tell you one day, Jagdeer smiled.
I'm up at 18:30, I believe, Blanchard said.
And the Reese is taking a Unit 4 out at 21:40. I'll stand down until Markwell is compass mentis.
Good flying, he said,
and jogged away to check on his machine. I wish people would stop saying that, Jagdeer thought. Palace Pier, 1550. Night had arrived early, and a wan darkness had settled over the sea. It looked as if a storm was brewing. Afternoon trade had been bad all week, and now, with a gloomy pall spreading in the west, it had dried up altogether. Becker sent Latrice home and closed up early. It would make a change. A few extra hours' sleep. She was locking the cafe door when the man appeared. There was a brisk wind coming off the foreshore, tugging at her coat and buffeting her, so she hadn't heard him walk up.
Oh,
she exclaimed, jumping. It was the sad-faced pilot who'd never tasted shellfish. He was huddled in a heavy leather coat.
Are you closed?
He asked.
Yes,
she said, brushing wind-tugged hair out of her eyes.
Sorry, there was no one around this afternoon. Didn't like the look of the weather, I suppose.
He glanced up at the sky as if he hadn't really noticed. The first few spats of rain were falling.
I understand, he said. I got a decent walk, at least. Good afternoon, mademoiselle. Wait,
she called after him. Becker shook her head at herself. She was too soft for her own good.
You're hungry, aren't you?
A little, he admitted.
She unlocked the door.
Come on, I'll make you something.
But you're closed.
I can open again.
She had him sit at the table he'd chosen the day before, while she went behind the counter, turned on the water heater, and started looking through the pantry bins. Viltry noticed she didn't change the card in the window. The cafe was still shut to others.
This is very kind of you, he called.
It's no problem. You don't like fish, do you?
I don't really know.
You're in luck. We have some salt ham today. The storm closed in, turning the sky as dark as twilight. Becker turned on the cafe's oil lamps. Rain began to patter and drum against the windows and the skylights, running down them in torrents so they seemed to be melting. The whole pier creaked gently as the sea stirred around it. She'd never been out at the pier end during a storm before. It felt unnerving, and half of her wished she'd simply been firm with him and gone home. The whole place felt exposed and vulnerable, alone amid the turbulent elements. It was like riding aboard some fragile craft through a maelstrom. He didn't seem the slightest bit bothered. When she brought his food and drink, she sat down with him.
You're an aviator, sir?
Yes,
he took a bite.
This is really very good. I don't think I'd realized how hungry I was.
Imperial Navy? She asked.
He shook his head and wiped his lips with a napkin.
Sort of, I suppose. Imperial Fantine Air Corps. My name's Viltry, Oscar Viltry.
Becca Mayer.
He held out his hand and shook hers courteously.
Thank you for your hospitality, mademoiselle, and act of kindness towards a stranger to your world. Seeing as you've come here to risk your life fighting for my world, I think a plate of ham and bread is the least I can do.
He stopped eating suddenly and frowned.
I know you from somewhere, don't I?
I was here yesterday.
No, somewhere else.
The Templum, early the other day. You held the door for me.
Yes, that's it.
An especially fierce gust of wind rattled the windows and threw the rain against the glass with renewed vigour.
I suppose this place will stand up to a storm,
Viltry asked.
I think it'd take a lot to bring the palace down,
she replied. It was another hour before the storm abated enough for them to want to risk a dash back towards the town. Refilling his cup, she chatted idly, to no real point, as if simply letting go of conversation that loneliness had dammed up inside her. Viltry was content just to listen. His day had been terrible. The savage air brawl, the panic and fear. The bats had locked them up so long, they'd finally been forced to ditch their payloads and turn back on the long, exposed slog for home. No target destroyed. No target even seen. Just a portion of the dish of sand heat-fused into glass. Halo had lost no one, but five of its machines had been damaged, and several crewmen hurt. K for Killshot had been unable to do more than crawl home. Part of its payload had been hung, and Viltry feared that even if it got back, it might stumble on landing and be annihilated by its own munitions. But they'd made it. Three of Exor's wing and two Thunderbolt escorts, however, had not. Some aviators dealt with the pressure of a combat tour by drinking or hedonistic escapes,
others by sounding off about what had happened to anybody in the crew room who'd listen. That had never been Viltry's way. These days, he was afraid that if he started talking, he wouldn't be able to stop. But listening to the woman talk eased him. It was like an antidote to the tension of combat. It gave him a touch of perspective, reminded him the universe was not simply him, harnessed into a G-chair, waiting for fate's wheel to turn. Her life was evidently hard. She was forced to work two shifts, here during the day and overnight at the munitions manufactory. She was worried about the tide of the war. Fresh food was getting harder to come by. What if the cafe was forced to close? She had a brother, called Ido, who was serving in the land army. She'd not heard from him for over 3 months, since the fighting at the gates of the Trinity Hives. He'd be home soon, she was convinced. She lit a candle for him every day.
I light three. One for Gart, one for Ido, and one for whoever else needs it.
Viltry smiled.
I remember that. Pardon me, but who's Gart? My husband, Commander Viltry. He was a pilot officer in the Commonwealth PDF. He was lost over the desert the winter before last. I'm sorry, mademoiselle. Is he listed missing?
She shook her head.
I can assure myself my brother is alive because I've not had proof otherwise. But Gart is dead.
The Commonwealth had given her a widow's pension, but that had dried up when the war effort took its latest bad turn. Hence the two jobs. The lack of sleep. Viltry noticed that the rain had eased. There was a lightness back in the sky. She would be late for her shift if they didn't take advantage of the break. She locked the cafe doors, and they hurried down the wet boardwalk towards the town, where the evening lamps were coming on.